Slate spoiler specials are brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free audiobook when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audiblepodcast.com/spoiler.
Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Life of Pi, the new Ang Lee movie based on the best-selling novel by Jan Martel. Joining me here in the Slate New York studio is Slate contributor Dan Ingber. Hey, Dan.
Hi, Dana.
So we saw Life of Pi together night before last, was it?
Yes.
Glasses and all, we managed to find a 3D screening. Mm-hmm. Thank God, because you're Slate's resident expert on 3D. So we'll definitely get to that and
okay,
how it looks
good.
And how you feel about the 3D technology. But I'd like to start these off with just a quick kind of like it or hate it reaction so people know whether, you know, we're telling them to go to the movie or not.
Okay. Me first?
Yeah, you go first.
I just found it incredibly annoying.
And you
I would recommend against it. I was so excited for this movie, but I can't.
Because of the book or because of the 3D?
I liked the book. I don't remember anything about the book, but I accept that I liked it. I thought that it was mindlessly good. And I know that I thought that the movie would be mindlessly amazing. And I found it mindless and amazing, but above all of that, annoying. Just so annoying that I wouldn't tell anyone to sit through it.
And you would locate that annoyingness in the movie's philosophy, theology, spirituality, kind of woo-woo side?
Yeah, but also, and we can get to this, but it all comes down to the tiger. And I wasn't buying the tiger. And
you weren't buying the tiger as a digital creation or as a narrative element?
As a digital creation. In the book, I bought the tiger, you know, whole hog. I loved the tiger. And what was so great about the book was the way that sort of tiger-boy relationship comes alive. But in the movie, I just thought it's just, you know, it's like an animated, you know, gussied up Tony the Tiger. Who cares? So
it's
annoying.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's take a step back for those who haven't seen at least the trailer to this movie. I feel like everybody in the Western world must know that Life of Pi is about a boy and a tiger in a lifeboat together, because even when the book came out and I sort of wasn't on the bandwagon of reading it, that much was known to all.
That's the elevator pitch for Life of Pi.
But let's set up how that comes to happen in the
okay.
story. So we have a frame story in this movie, which is actually not the case in the book. We start off with essentially the story of the creation of the book. So there's this stand-in for Jan Martel, played by Rafe Spall, this young French-Canadian writer who goes to visit a middle-aged Indian man, played by Irfan Khan. They're in Canada. Do they say what city in Canada?
I think they're in Montreal.
In Montreal?
Yeah.
And he's visiting him in his apartment because he's heard from a common acquaintance that this man, Pi, has an incredible story to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And so then Pi proceeds to narrate his story. We jump in flashback back to India, and mm-hmm. he's played by a young boy, and we see him growing up with a zookeeper father in the town of Pondicherry who runs this very kind of posh zoo.
Yes.
And full of sloths and wonderful animals that we see at the beginning. I did really love the credit sequence mm-hmm. in which we see this very deep 3D image of all these great-looking wild animals crawling around in beautiful kind of peach-colored buildings in India.
Yes.
With a really neat effect also where the words kind of weave in and out of the animals.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a pet interest of mine is how do you do 3D credits? Where on the depth axis do you put them? Do you put them all the way in the front, you know, right in the audience's lap or right at the level of the screen? Because, of course, they have to be in front of everything. Or do you try to kind of position them in space? And I thought it was clever the way Ang Lee or his credits people kind of mixed it up. And sometimes they were kind of behind a branch or something.
Right, or peeking from behind mm-hmm. a giraffe's yeah. neck or something like that. It is a really luscious opening credit sequence that makes you excited about the movie in a way that doesn't necessarily materialize.
Yeah.
So is there anything you want to say about this childhood sequence before we get to Guy in a Boat with a Tiger? Because it's a pretty extended part of the movie. It's seeing what kind of child he was and what his relationship with his father was like and what his relationship with spirituality was like. He's this very religious little kid who's brought up mm-hmm. Hindu but is very drawn to Christianity and to Islam and starts incorporating rituals from those religions into his daily life to his secular father's annoyance.
I thought I really enjoyed the beginning part, and I felt that it was kind of a sequence of really meticulous created images or tableau. It kind of reminded me of a Wes Anderson movie a little bit, especially the opening bit with the swimming pool in Paris, after which he's named Pi, stands for piscine, and it's his uncle's favorite swimming pool. I was really into that. I thought I love underwater 3D. There's a long history of great underwater 3D. So I was just, you know, pleased as punch with the way it was going. And then it starts to get into a little bit of that spirituality stuff and that and those sort of tableau kind of drag on to this narrative bit where it's not clear where it's going. And I'm wondering, when does he get in the boat with the tiger?
Well, what did you think of the sacrifice of the goat at the beginning? That was probably the most striking and the most maybe one of the most violent scenes in the whole movie, including stuff that happens on the lifeboat.
Yeah, I found it disappointing because, again, the tiger just was this, you know, weirdly too smooth. I mean, I think the whole movie is weirdly too smooth, but it begins with the tiger. You know, the way he's creeping down this long hallway to get the goat. And then just what happens when he finally makes that lunge that the whole scene sets up for, he just kind of smoothly slides the goat through the bars.
You would never actually see the goat go through the bars, do you? It's like a magic trick that he could get that wide of a goat through those bars.
It reminded me of Terminator 2, the famous moment where Jason Patrick, I don't know if it's really famous, where Jason Patrick...
famous in your mind.
Yeah, exactly. Where he just walks, he melted metal walks through the bars. And that's kind of what happens to the goat, I guess, off camera. But the next thing you know, the whole goat is being carried off by the cartoon tiger. And I mean, why am I making a big deal? It just seemed unrealistic, but it just really, for me, set the tone of, you know, this doesn't have this, what's going on doesn't have a material reality. It just looks digital.
Right. That becomes, when we get to spoiling, that becomes a big question, whether or not what's happening has a material reality, right?
Right.
I mean, not just in terms of, you know, does the digitization look real, but just is this happening on a plane of imagination or fantasy? And if so, what happens to the suspense? I mean, there's a lot of layers to the way this story is told.
Yeah. I mean, this movie's been compared to Avatar in advance. I don't know if it's being compared to Avatar now in retrospect, but in the sense that it's this big budget, you know, whole family, fantastical 3D digital creation with far out imagery. And I think that it pulls kind of an Avatar move. I mean, one of the smart things about Avatar is that the whole world that you're in when you're on the planet is kind of this projected digital space. He's lying in his, Sam Worthington's lying in a tube and projecting his mind to the space. It's the same thing that the Matrix does. I think it's a clever way to introduce fancy special effects. You say the whole world is created.
Yeah, you put a frame of virtuality around it, and then you're free to do anything within it.
But to me, the Life of Pi, it was a mistake. I mean, I understood because the whole theme of the movie is this about make-believe and constructing stories and constructing realities, and we can talk about what happens at the very end. But what happens in the book is that it feels so real on the boat. That's why I really enjoyed the book. It really that tiger comes alive, you know, to use the cliche of reading books. But in here, I just felt like starting with that goat scene, the tiger was not coming alive. The artifice was forefront, and that didn't help me sort of enjoy this idea of a fabricated world. It made me worry that the power of storytelling isn't all that it's cracked up to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I disagree that the tiger did not seem at all convincing or alive. I mean, while you're aware that he's a digital creation because you just couldn't train a tiger to do all of those things, there were moments where I thought, is this a motion-captured tiger? Or in this particular shot, did they use a real tiger? And I would love to see a making-of featurette about how that tiger was created, because I think he has at least as much kind of physical weight and seeming reality in the space that he's in as, say, Gollum does in the Lord of the Rings movies. Obviously, you don't have the performance side because the tiger's not anthropomorphized, which is a good thing, right? He doesn't talk and he's not given any particular, he's not magical. It's not magical realist in that way, right? The movie does still want you to believe that there's a carnivorous beast operating by instinct living in this lifeboat. And I thought for that stretch of the middle of the movie, which we should cut to now, right? So kid grows up enough to be a teenager, right? Kid falls in love, and there's a short little sidebar about that. But the main thing is Pi the kid, the teenage kid, gets on an ocean liner with his family and all the animals in the somewhat economically impractical decision to transport them all to Canada before selling them. And the ship sinks, right?
Was that sinking scene?
I thought it was fantastic. I mean, having also just seen Titanic on the big screen in 3D, it did remind me of Titanic. It was really clear that there were some shots that were based on it, but it was a really spectacular disaster scene, especially with the animals thrown in, right? I mean, if you've got him swimming through the completely flooded corridors to save his family, and then suddenly a zebra goes swimming by, it just adds this kind of absurd element. All that stuff's in the trailer, and I think that that's some of the more exhilarating moments of the movie.
Yes. So he escapes on a lifeboat, and he somehow finds himself in the lifeboat with a bunch of animals.
Right. So the animals in the lifeboat, let's go over them now so I can make sure that I understand what's happening on both the allegorical and literal levels. He wakes up in the lifeboat with a zebra that's broken its legs or gotten wounded in some way in its leap from the ship onto the lifeboat.
Right.
A hyena, right?
He discovers there's a hyena.
That's sort of hiding under the canvas tarp that's covering half the boat. And later on it turns out, oh, no, the orangutan's not initially on the boat, but he sees the orangutan floating toward him on a bale of bananas.
Right.
And so this female orangutan gets on the ship as well. It seems to be one that he is close to from his days as the zookeeper's son. And lastly,
the tiger,
who doesn't reveal himself. I mean, that's somewhat unrealistic that the tiger is going to take 2 full days to reveal itself because it's curled under this tarp. But, you know, maybe it was resting from the exertion of the shipwreck. So these animals on the boat, it's not a movie about a kid on a boat with 4 animals, right? Obviously, we know it's down to him and the tiger pretty soon. The animals make short work of each other in ways that become important later on, but that at the time basically just sort of seem like survival of the fittest, right? The tiger is the last one because it's the biggest and strongest. And then comes the middle section of the movie that I thought was the strongest and the closest thing to being a real sort of survival adventure, you know, sort of a Swiss family Robinson kind of moment in the movie when Pi has to figure out how he's going to make his peace with living in this lifeboat with a tiger. And I know that whenever I would hear about this book or this movie, I would think, why isn't it just 10 minutes long? Why isn't it Tiger Eats Boy, game over? And that all has to do with, again, some things that are in the magic realist realm that are hard to believe, but others that seem like real sort of survivalist practical advice. So he builds this satellite to the boat by lashing together a bunch of oars and flotation devices and life vests and things and ties it to the boat so that he's got this separate space to be in where the tiger can't come and get him. And then over the course of this period, he tries to figure out, okay, how do I make my way, shimmy up this rope and get food and supplies out of the boat without the tiger knowing about it? Or how do I eventually tame the tiger so that he'll let me get on the boat with him?
Yeah, and I think it does sort of capture some of this complicated relationship between him and the tiger, even towards the beginning where he's kind of inclined to feed the tiger, but he's also, you know, the tiger is threatening his life the whole time.
Yeah, well, here's where the goat sacrifice scene from the flashback becomes important, because the whole idea of the goat sacrifice scene, right, is that the father gives the goat to the tiger in order to prove to the boy how red in tooth and claw nature is, right? And that he shouldn't have been innocently offering some meat to the tiger with his hand as he was doing before because his arm could get bitten off. So the question of how much compassion to show the tiger and whether to regard it as a legitimate other, you know, who you owe some sort of ethical debt to, or simply a predator who you fear, it becomes the conflict at the center of the movie. Mm-hmm. And when I hear myself...
Did you even say what you think of the movie?
Yeah, when I hear myself describing this middle section, it sounds like a really good movie, especially given the fact that it is so visually inventive and the images are so crisp and clear and kind of, at times, kind of devastatingly beautiful. At times, a little Hallmarkishly beautiful, right? But, I mean, this movie is definitely kind of brimming with memorable images. But yet, I think I came away with the same kind of feeling as you. I really could not get with this movie. Its whole gambit about wanting us to believe in this story and root for the kid and root for his survival and care about individual moments of suspense. Will he get bitten right now? Seemed to be completely undercut by several things. By knowing, of course, that he makes it to middle age and turns into Irfan Khan and tells his story to Rafe's ball. But also by the fact that everything always seemed in danger of slipping into some gauzy, metaphoric, theological space where it wasn't really what it seemed to be about.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I mean, so what happens, I guess we can just spoil it, that at the end, Pi survives. The tiger wanders off into the jungle somewhere.
They make it all the way across the Pacific to Mexico, right?
Yeah, they're in Mexico. So I thought at the end maybe there could be one of those kind of, you know, post-credit things where they have a picture of the tiger and then, you know, text on the screen that says the tiger went on to get married and have 2 kids.
Become an insurance agent.
Yeah, exactly.
Dan, let me stop you there for just a minute for a word from our sponsor. The Spoiler Podcast is delighted to be sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of digital spoken audio information entertainment on the web. They offer more than 100,000 audiobook titles, which you can play on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now. And they have a special offer for Spoiler listeners. You can get a 30-day free trial and 1 free audiobook by signing up here, audiblepodcast.com/spoiler. And as it happens, Audible has Life of Pi, the novel narrated by Jeff Woodman, who seems to be a major audiobook narrator. He narrates dozens of books on the site, including all of Jonathan Safran Foer's work, and gets high reviews as a reader. So Life of Pi, narrated by Jeff Woodman, is available. And again, you can find that by going to audiblepodcast.com/spoiler.
So the tiger wanders off, and Pi gets interviewed by insurance inspectors from the shipping company.
Since he's the only survivor of the shipwreck.
The only survivor. And he tells his story about the tiger, and they kind of call BS on him. And then finally, he admits or comes up with another story, not totally clear, in which it's the whole tiger thing was just an allegory. The tiger was kind of the dark side of Pi that allowed him to survive, and that the hyena was the very slimy Gerard Depardieu character.
Right, who was a cook on the ship.
Right, and the orangutan was Pi's mother, and Gerard Depardieu killed everyone else on the boat, and then the tiger side of Pi came out, and he killed Gerard Depardieu, and then... And then that's it. And then we cut
but
back
we
to Irfan Khan.
We should say that this is all Rafe Spall's interpretation, right? There's also a very, I thought, very dull kind of glossing, you know, a Talmudic moment where they go over the story together, Rafe Spall and Irfan Khan. And yeah. Rafe Spall makes all these equivalencies like, I get it. The orangutan was your mother. The hyena was the cook, right? And he right. kind of breaks it all down in the alternate reading. The movie does leave us in some suspense as to which reading we should believe is true. But essentially, it hands us this insight, which I think is supposed to be the kind of crowning inside of the movie and maybe the book. I haven't finished the book, but that seemed to me kind of profoundly depressing, which is that, you know, if there's a really good story and the truth, you should believe the story and ignore the truth.
And so it is with God, Dana. That's the concluding line after Rafe Spall makes that
Irfan Khan
point.
Says, and so it is with God.
And so it is with God. And then there you have it.
That's, like, believe his lies too?
I guess.
It's just I found that so narratively unsatisfying, and that just may be an ineluctable spiritual flaw of mine. I don't think any story could satisfy me where after a long suspenseful narrative I was just told none of that actually happened. This other horrible thing happened that we're not going to give you any more details about, but just believe this is true because it's wholesome for us all somehow.
Well, does the movie so the movie doesn't hold up for you or for me as you know, a narrative masterpiece, but does it hold up as kind of a Kiwanis Kotze microcosmos? You know, get high and watch it and
well,
love
actually,
it.
That was the lead to my review, is that this movie makes you feel like you're stoned. I don't know if it would actually be fun to see when you're stoned, especially if you're someone who becomes hyper-analytical like
right.
me, because then the woo-woo kind of metaphysical claptrap would become even more annoying. But just on a sheer visual level, yeah, the spectacle is quite incredible. But I'm not someone, I don't think, who can just drift away on visual mm-hmm. spectacle when the story that it's cloaking seems just somehow basically lacking.
Yeah. You know what? The movie reminded me at one point of 2001. Did that cut? There's a sequence in the middle I was hoping we could talk about where it's, I guess, a dream. Pi looks into the water and has a dream. And the camera sort of sinks into the water and it gets very digital and crazy. And
non-narrative, right? There's sea monsters swishing by through the depths. And mm-hmm. he eventually sees the Simsum, that's the name of the ship that sank, right? The Japanese
yeah.
ship is just at the bottom of the ocean. It's a visually incredible moment. And I actually did love that it became unanchored from narrative right then and sort of went spiraling into Pi's brain. I don't think it's incredibly well integrated with the rest of the movie, but mm-hmm. I did look forward to those moments.
It reminded me so much of the you know, the swirling psychedelic stuff in 2001. And then I started thinking about, you know, our Pi and Tiger as Dave and Hal and wondering if there was, you know, if there's something. I like 2001. I didn't find it annoying, but why couldn't I get on board? Because that sequence was fantastic and fabulous and, you know, in the true sense of the words. So what's the difference?
I don't know. I mean, for one thing, I was just going to say that I think the questions in 2001 are much smarter. The relationship
right.
between Dave and Hal and the kind of questions that it raises about what humanity is and what technology is and how they relate to each other just seem like more interesting questions to me than the very six of one, half a dozen of the other kind of question of which of these horrible versions of the story of someone losing their entire family in a shipwreck
right.
is true.
And so it is with God, Dave.
Right. Well, that's another thing is that God doesn't just sort of get plugged in at the end of 2001
right.
as an explanation for everything. There's an open-endedness so extreme that nobody really knows what the end of 2001 is about.
Mm-hmm.
But at least it's not, oh, G-O-D, you know, stamp of approval at the end of the movie.
So what did you think of the effects? It sounds like you liked them, the digital effects, the 3D. I mean, I think we could separate those two things out.
I liked both the digital effects and 3D, I guess, if we're separating them out. I thought the tiger was a very impressive creation, technically. I believed in his physical reality, and it scared me when he seemed like he was about to chomp Pi's arm off, even though I knew that all the arms were going to make it back to Montreal.
I loved the meerkats, which I guess were all.
Oh, the island. Let's talk really quickly about the island as well, because that's a visually incredible passage in the movie. Mm-hmm. So shortly before he winds up in Mexico, right? Very shortly before. In fact, there's an ellipsis in between the island segment and him being rescued from the shipwreck that makes it seem like, oh, after that, it was a piece of cake, right? But he bumps up against this island that couldn't possibly exist on Earth. It seems to be made entirely of the tangled roots of the dense trees that grow all over this island, and is populated solely, except for insects, I guess, by these meerkats that cover the entire surface of the island, like little, almost like little worms popping up out of the ground. And that was a really witty and fabulous image when you first see the meerkats popping up.
Yeah, and they're so adorable. And there's so many of them, I think, that it's one place where, for me, I wasn't distracted by the lack of you know, real lifiness to them. One of the things that comes up in the movie, in the script, I guess, is this idea of looking into an animal and seeing the soul in its eyes. And it's part of the kind of woo-woo stuff. But that's what I think what made me unforgiving on the tiger's artifice is there are several moments where it's a close-up of the tiger's eyes and where you and Pi are staring into that totally computer-animated tiger. And you're supposed to just be, you know, transported by the understanding that an animal has a soul and it's not, you know, just a goat-eating machine. That's where, versus the meerkats, where there's just supposed to be this weird island full of adorable meerkats. But at those moments when you're staring into the tiger's eyes, I'm pushing you on this just because I'm confused that you thought it was realistic.
You want to know, did I feel a profound spiritual revelation about man's relationship to mammals?
Did you feel like that? I mean, if it was a real tiger, when you look into, you know, the eyes of the black stallion or the donkey, you know, Balthazar or whatever, do you think that animal has a soul? I mean, I do, but I think that's a natural inclination. But when you looked into Richard Parker's eyes.
Right. Well, we haven't even mentioned that the tiger is called Richard Parker, right? Because of a bureaucratic mix-up between him and the person who delivered him to the zoo. No, I don't think I felt much when I looked into the eyes of Richard Parker. But I think I was blaming that on the script and the general, you know, the general manipulativeness of the movie as much as the digitization of the tiger. I think I didn't feel the tiger's soul because I felt too intensely that the movie wanted me to feel it, and I just resisted that sentimentalization.
I think if it was a real tiger, no matter how lousy the script. I mean, I think if you look the tiger in the eye in the Siegfried and Roy 3D spectacular, you'll think that's an animal with a soul.
Mm-hmm.
animal has meaning. No, I don't know. I think it was a fatal flaw that you have these moments where you're supposed to stare the animal in the eyes and care, and it's just impossible.
I hear that. And I love the negative comparison with the Siegfried and Roy spectacular. Now there was artistry.
Yeah, you know, I saw your review. You described it as being immersed in caramel, and that's very much the feeling that I had, that it was just kind of soft and smooth and gooey and therefore it didn't really feel like there was real space on the screen. And I wonder if that's just because of the way that the, you know, the live action and the animated stuff fit together, or if it had to do with the animated stuff not quite looking real, so it wasn't clear how it fit in space.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, I wasn't thinking so much visual caramel as kind of narrative caramel,
right?
You know, the stickiness of the story. But I definitely felt some bedazzlement at the at the use of 3D, and some moments where it was incredibly crisp and beautiful. More so when it wasn't trying to integrate life and fakeness. It was when it was frankly artificial and kind of glorying in that artificiality that it was at its most beautiful, like the dive into the ocean that you described.
Yeah, I just love that and wish there were more 3D sequences like that.
Yeah, it makes me wish that Ang Lee would make more dreamscape folktale kind of movies, because I do feel like this movie is not at all cynically made or sort of, you know, there's nothing about it that doesn't feel deeply felt by him, you know. And so maybe it will move other people who are more open to this kind of story than I am, or people who really love the book and want to see it's pretty faithful to the book, I gather.
What did you think of the boy? It's never acted before.
The Teenaged Pie, the actor, the main one. The actor's named Suraj Sharma, and you just told me it's his first time acting. He was a complete novice to the screen, which makes me more impressed. I mean, it's a very physically demanding part, that's for sure. He basically, I'm sure when he was filming, it had to be alone in a room, you know, full of, I don't know what, like CGI dot markers for where the tiger was going to be, you know, acting with tennis ball on the stick as they used to do in CGI. And I think he brings a lot of realism to it.
Yeah, I thought he was pretty good, considering. I mean, I was thinking about that issue that he's acting off of no one.
Yeah, and given that he's never acted before, it's pretty impressive. That's the part that holds the screen, I think, is that middle 30-minute stretch. It's when other people get on screen. I love Irfan Khan, the older Indian actor who plays him as an adult, but that part is just so Deepak Chopra. You know, it's just a guy dispensing New Age wisdom that there's not much he can do with it.
And just all the close-ups of Rafe's ball looking bewildered.
Right, wide-eyed and bedazzled with the story that he's about to go home and type and turn into an Oprah's book bestseller.
Right.
All right. Well, Dan, thanks so much for coming in. You actually have brought me a lot of new perspective on the 3D. And also, I now feel ashamed that I cared about the tiger. I want to watch again and see if I can see his fakeness, because I tend to be very hard on CGI animals in movies and think that they're fakey no matter what. But I really bought Richard Parker.
Try reading the book. I think you'll buy him more in the literary version than the digital version.
Yeah, you were holding him up to a higher standard of your memory from the book, no doubt. All right, well, thanks, and please come in and spoil another movie with me soon.
I'd love to. Thanks.
Our producer is Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.